Okay, tonight at 40 Minute Speakers, Teresa.
Hi, everybody. My name's Teresa, and I'm an alcoholic. Let me get this right level here. Can you see me? No. Oh, golly. I'm delighted to be here at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm glad you're all here. I want to thank James for asking me to speak. I got to tell you, before I got sober, nobody was asking me to show up. In fact, they were saying, please don't come, you know. I also want to thank my friend Anthony for being my compañero all the way down here. I thought there was a 10-minute speaker, you guys. I got him down here on the pretense that he was going to get to speak for 10 minutes, and then you don't have that. So, my bad, mea culpa, but he's been a gracious companion, and we had a lovely dinner, and I want to thank him. It's been really nice. You know, I mean, Friday nights. I mean, you know, who would have thought that I would be at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know, and be glad and, you know, standing like upright and have all my clothes on and you know, because like I said, before I got sober, I was not asked to show up. In fact, I was asked to not come. I can remember vividly a birthday party of a niece of mine. My sister said, please don't come. And I was staying over in the Bay. I lived in the Bay Area. I grew up there, and I was staying over in Marin County. And I knew I was too drunk and too loaded to drive to this party. So I took a cab from Corte Madera to I don't know, someplace in Point Richmond. And when I got to the park, they opened the cab door, and I fell out of the cab. I never got up. I mean, like, that was like as good as it got. I have no recollection of the party. I know that that's what happened. I was asked not to come to the birth of my second niece because I would cause a scene, and I came, and I did. I caused a scene, you know, and it was, you know, that was just the way it was. I'm here to tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And the reason I don't say what it's like is because guess what? It's still the same out there. It hasn't changed a bit. I don't want to go out there and have to do what I used to do because the sober life for me is, you know, I am well blessed and overpaid being sober. As I said, I grew up in Northern California. There were four of us initially. My mother was killed in a car accident when I was really young. And then I had a stepmother, and she had a kid, and then she married my dad. Well, I don't know when she married my dad, but anyway, then there were seven of us. And so that was a big family, you know. They don't have big families like that too much anymore, you know. But the way it was my father was not an alcoholic, but he was kind of a rageaholic, you know. I mean, he had everybody in the whole house scared to death of him, you know, me included. So it was all kind of the kids against him. But he was gone a lot. He was gone a lot. But you know what? I was just not right. I mean, I always felt like the redheaded stepchild, and by then I was, you know. And I was skinny and buck-toothed and just weird, you know. I had this older sister who was perfect and a younger sister who was darling, and then there was me, you know. I was intense, you know, and I would, you know, my first drug or drink of choice was running away from home, you know, taking geographics, now we call it that. And I used to run away from home on a regular basis. First, when I was little, it started out just going up to the overpass, one of those walking overpasses, and I would just bring all my stuff up there and my little graham crackers. Kind of wished that somebody would come and look for me, you know, and they never did. It would be like late, it would be dark, and I'd be like trooping home with my blanket. And they wouldn't even miss me. There were so damn many kids in the house, you know. So you know, I don't know. I was kind of rebellious. I was angry. You know, I just wanted attention, and I would do things to get attention. Early on in school, you know, back in high school then, we had dress codes, you know, like you had to wear a dress to school. But you couldn't wear the dress, couldn't be too short, because they sent you home. So I'd wear too short. They'd send me home, mini skirt, you know. Then I'd wear a granny dress, a long dress. You couldn't wear that. They'd send me home. So one time I just wore my coat, you know, over my underwear. They sent me home. I don't know why. I wasn't wearing a dress that was the wrong length, you know. I mean, you know, I didn't really fit in. My family was not well off. So I couldn't be a cheerleader and all that kind of stuff. So I took 4 years of art. That was my favorite class, was art with Mr. Bergeloff. And, you know, I was kind of like, if when they made that movie Carrie about her going to the senior prom, that would have been me if I would have went to my senior prom. Because I wanted to burn the place down, basically. I mean, I just wanted out of there. And so early on, when I was about 16, I left home and I went to live with somebody else. And I basically never lived with my parents after I was 16. I graduated from high school early, and the day I graduated from high school, I went to New York City. I just thought it was like, I live on the West Coast. I wanted to get as far away from my family as I could, so I went to New York City. But prior to that time, I was very involved in the tune in, turn on, drop out movement. You know, we didn't have anything about just say thanks. We didn't just say no. We just said thanks. Just give it to you. Yeah, give it up. I was at the B-Inn in Golden Gate Park. I lived across the bay from Golden Gate Park in East Bay, San Francisco East Bay, and you know, my grandma lived in, right up in the panhandle, right above the panhandle of San Francisco, and my great-grandma lived out in the avenues by the beach, and I used to take the bus when I was younger and then hitchhike when I was in high school. I used to hitchhike across the Bay Bridge all the time to go to San Francisco, and we would just hang out in the Haight-Ashbury, and we would I went to the B-Inn in Golden Gate Park in 1967, and, you know, there was just, you know, Timothy Leary and his whole gang of merry pranksters, and you know, somebody threw up a huge box of sugar cubes that were all coated with LSD, and, you know, it was just fun. It was just fun, 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 you know. My first drink was, I remember my first drink, it was Pagan Pink Ripple Wine, and let me tell you, it tasted like soda pop. Went down easy, but it got you where you wanted to go. And when I got drunk that night, I can remember walking around the park by my house. I lived on Gomer Street when I was growing up, and the park was called Patrick Gomer Park, and we got drunk there all the time. And I'm drinking this Ripple wine, and I'm thinking, where have you guys been keeping this stuff? This was great. I was like, man, I feel so good. This, why would anyone not want to walk around drunk? This feels so good. You know, it just was like, turn your head off. Do not think about how, you know, skinny, redheaded, buck-tooth you are. You know, you're just like cool, you know? And after that, you know, I did not want to be... See, because when I was growing up as an alcoholic, it was just not okay to be who I was, you know? And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because today, with my sobriety and who I am, it's okay to be me, you know? It's okay. But back then, I did not want to be me. I wanted to be anybody else but me. And I it was just not okay. And so anyway, I went to New York City. I learned how to drink hard liquor in New York City. Back then, you could drink, you could go into bars and drink when you were 18 in New York. I was 17. I looked about 12, but I was tall and I could reach the bar, you know. And I learned how to drink Calvert's Canadian whiskey, and man, I was off. And that was the time when the Fillmore East was going on, and I was an aficionado of Fillmore West. And, you know, I had spent many, many times on the Bill Graham's Days on the Green, which, incidentally, I didn't think I had a good time unless I was so loaded and drunk I ended up in the first aid tent. You know, I mean, that was when I knew I had arrived, you know, that they had to, like, cart me away on a stretcher, you know. I mean, that was what I aspired to. You know, I'd get up in the morning for those concerts, you know, and we'd start the day with a huge gallon of orange juice that was mostly vodka, you know. And then we go on to other substances, and by about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, someone would pass me a angel dust joint, and they go, there she goes, boom, you know, and that was it, you know, and I missed many a good headliner, you know, because I was in the first aid tent. So, you know, when I went to New York, and again, I think about it now, and I took tremendous risks with my life, you know, I mean, I could not imagine having a daughter doing the things that I did back then. I mean, I would get in a car and go anywhere with anyone at any time. It didn't matter. I mean, I got in the back of motorcycles. I remember driving down the West Side Highway loaded on LSD. Just insane, you know, on the back of this motorcycle. To this day, I have no idea who it was, who I was with. You know, it wasn't my motorcycle, you know, and I don't know where we were coming from or where we were going, but I was like, woohoo! You know, that was just the way it was. You know, and because it just, I could not feel the way I felt. I just thought if you felt the way I did, you would have to drink and use too. You know, it was just not okay. As I mentioned, my mother died when I was young, and I just never ever came to terms with that at all, really, and until probably after a lot of inventories, and I probably still need therapy, but it's too expensive, so we don't do that, you know. But whatever. And I went to New York, and the year was 1968, and the economy was great, you know, and I worked at Creative Playthings and Rockefeller Center, and we used to have bands in there, the Modern Jazz Quartet, and we used to drink after work and watch the ice skaters go around in the Rockefeller Center ice rink, and, you know, it was just great. I mean, it was just living large, you know. I mean, I didn't think anything was wrong, you know. And I came back to the Bay Area, and I went to school, and I got heavily involved with really heavy drugs. And I ended up in a program up in Mendocino State Hospital called The Family. And, you know, at that time I knew I was a drug addict, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And incidentally, if any of you out there are wondering, you know, if I'm an alcoholic, if I'm an addict, just catch alcoholism, you know, because we got recovery here. We got a program for alcoholism here. So, you know, I went up to the program, and I came out from the program, and I actually started a program. We came down to Southern California and started this program called Tarzana Center. It's still in existence. And, you know, it was a program to help with drug and alcohol addiction. And but again, I knew that now by that time I wasn't doing drugs, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic. You know, I just didn't know that, you know, drinking did something different for me that it didn't do to regular people. So I kept drinking, you know. I later got back into drugs as well too, but I personally think that my drug usage just helped me be able to drink longer and harder, you know. I am an alcoholic. I have alcoholism. You know, my thinking is skewed. You know, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. You know, I mean, in today's world, you know, it's tough to be an alcoholic. That's why I'm glad that we have these meetings. You know, because otherwise we'd be out there. You know, and in here we understand. You know. It's kind of like Scott Redmond used to say, you know, if you got a plan, just tell us your plan, you know, because, you know, if you're new, it's probably a doozy, you know, but I mean, I always have plans. I think I tell Tony my plans all the time, you know, but I mean, it's just, you know, life is something that is very precious, and I'm really grateful to, you know, not be one of the casualties, because we've all had those friends that didn't make it, you know, that just didn't make it, and they're not with us anymore. So I kept on drinking, and my drinking got uglier, you know, and my disease progressed, and I can remember living in Berkeley, South Berkeley, on Shattuck Avenue in Northern California. And I lived in this sort of like hovel, this sort of like converted pump house. I'm not quite sure what it was. It had an outside rickety wooden stairs you got up to it. And, you know, I was out on the streets. I mean, I was, you know, from time to time we'd get some sleazy hustle together. You know, I remember one time we had one of these old, there was this bread company that used to deliver bread, and it was called Peter Wheat Bread. And we had one of these big bread trucks, and we had the truck, and what we would do, our little hustle to make money was we'd go around to Safeway stores, and we'd get those big old tons of cardboard that were all bound up, you know, and we'd roll them up into that truck, and then we'd hightail it out to Richmond to turn them into the recycling place, you know. I don't know. We lived on that. We lived on that for a while, I was out there on Shattuck Avenue, and I was crazy. I was drunk. Half the time I was drunk. I can remember getting arrested at that time. And I was sitting in the, I think it was Christmas. I think it was Christmas Day. And I got arrested, and I'm sitting in the back of the Oakland police car, a PD's car, and this policeman turned around, and he's pointing his finger, and he's giving me a lecture, and he's telling me I ought to be ashamed of acting the way I'm acting, you know, and doing what I'm doing. And I told him he ought to be ashamed of arresting me because I was just doing what I had to do to stay alive. You know, and I really believed that. I really meant that, you know. And there were times when I got drunk and I got beat up and I went to the hospital and I was still drunk and insane and I'm yelling at the police officers, and I remember this one police officer, he said, "You better shut up or I'm going to break your finger." And I wouldn't shut up, you know, and I was screaming. I was screaming, and he took this little finger and he went, and he broke it, you know, and it never got healed. I was like, "What's your badge number?" You know, I don't even, you know. I mean, I was insane. I was insane. Before I got sober, I used to have a lot of accidents with fire. I thought it was because I was a fire sign, I'm a Sagittarius, but it was mainly because I was drunk and loaded all the time. And I can remember, you know, back then they didn't have as many all-night stores. They didn't have like all-night 7-Elevens back then, but they had this one store in Oakland, California called Mayfair Markets that was open 24 hours. And I had this sleazy job taxi dancing at some dance hall down in Oakland, you know, which is a hideous way to make a living. But in any case, that was my night job. My day job was I went to school. I was in the art department. Sometimes I'd be too loaded to draw. They'd take pity on me. They'd make me the model. You know, they'd set me up on a chair. I'd hold my head up. But anyway, I'm coming home from this job about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd stop into Mayfair Markets. And I'd steal a couple quarts of Colt 45, you know, because that'll get you where you want to go. And I'd make it home, and I had this big coat, and I'd just stick them in the two pockets, and I'd get on home. Now, this place that I lived in, it had two rooms and a bathroom. And the water had long since been turned off. I didn't care because I didn't bathe anyway. I didn't like the way it felt on my skin. So... And it had like a sleeping loft that you had to access with a ladder. And so I got up the ladder and I got my quarts of beer, you know. And back then I used to smoke cigarettes, you know. And so, like I said, I had a lot of accidents with fire. Well, I'm up in my bed. I'm smoking. I'm drinking. I set the bed on fire. And now I'm thinking to myself, well, there's no water down. There might be a gallon of water somewhere. I don't know if I could find it. But if I try to get down, I'm too drunk. I'm going to break my leg. I knew it. I absolutely knew it. So I'm looking at this fire. It's burning over here, you know, and I'm looking at this quart, the second quart of beer, you know, and I got about this much in a quart of beer, you know, and I'm looking at the beer. I'm looking at the fire, you know. And so, like, I, like, poured just enough beer on that fire to put the flames out. That mattress smoldered all night, but God, you know, God had another plan for me because I didn't die, you know. And, you know, that was in 1973, and I was to go on drinking and using for another 10 years. So that tells you where I was at. What happened for me at that time, and I'm kind of rambling about the drunk log. What time do I finish anyway? Okay, I'll get sober soon. But I still had another 10 years of drinking. My solution at the time was to marry the connection. Actually, he was a manufacturer, So, you know, if money, property, and prestige of that ilk would get you sober, you'd have a different speaker, but it didn't. You know, all that happened was the cars got fancier, the houses got bigger, the parties got more frenetic. We'd have appeals, bonds, parties for people that had been busted, you know. We'd have, like, headliners at those parties and arrive in limousines. And I had a child. I got married. We did it in that order. My son was 3 when I got married. My wedding, I was 3 hours late for my own wedding. My husband was like, I think she's lost, you know. I don't know how true that was, really true at the time. But the fact was, is I had been freebasing the night before, and I just couldn't quite get it together, you know, with the veil and the flowers and, you know, the makeup. Oh, my God, I was 3 hours late for my own wedding. And the sad thing about that was, is that after we had this lovely service, you know, we got all these gifts and we trooped across the bay to go to the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, all overlooking Union Square in San Francisco. And, you know, we woke up in the morning and, you know, we were sick. We were drunk. We needed alcohol. We needed drugs. We couldn't even talk to each other, you know, because that was what it was. And, you know, we just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker together. I was continued to take geographics. I would run away to Mexico for 3 or 4 months and take a whole entourage and just call my husband and say, send more money. You know, I mean, because I would stay drunk and I would stay loaded because I knew that my parents had not raised me. I was raised a nice Catholic girl. I was not raised to be doing the things I was doing, you know, but I couldn't seem to stop, you know, and I just couldn't shut off my head because now a lot of time had gone under and there had been a lot of things that I had done that I was really, really ashamed of, you know, and I couldn't reconcile those things. And I couldn't shut off my mind. I mean, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror in the morning, you know, and I think it was the last Thanksgiving before I got sober. I was living, still in Northern California, and we tried to go and visit my folks who lived up in the mountains in Sonora, and you know, we didn't even get up. I mean, I looked at some pictures recently because I just celebrated 25 years of sobriety. And so I had a 25-year party, and I looked at some pictures. And I'm telling you guys, I did not get dressed for about 3 years. You know, I mean, I wore a nightgown. That's all I wore, you know. I don't know what I did. I never went out of the house. You know, and that particular Thanksgiving, we got up. We didn't get up until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we started our trip, and it was like, I don't know, an hour and a half drive to my folks. We turned back after a half an hour. We just couldn't do it. We just could not do it, you know. And that's really sad, because I love holidays. I really do. I came down to Southern California. The dates get kind of mixed up, because it was a long time ago. But I came down because I was in Mexico and I had met a man who was an astrologer and a poet and a musician, and he told me, but based on my astrology chart, that I had to change my life, and if I was going to be successful at it, I had to do it by a certain date, which was August of 1983. So August 29th, 1983, I was driving south on Highway 101 to come to school in Santa Monica. I had kicked all my drug habits, and now I was just not going to drink. I was just not going to drink, you know, because that was going to get me messed up. And I started in this school, and it was a 6-month program. James knows the school that I went to because it later moved. But I went to that school, and God, it was a 6-month program, and it took me about 9 months to get through it because I had to take 2 leaves of absence in 6 months, you know. And by this time, I could not control my drinking, you know. I mean, I certainly could not control and enjoy it. If I was controlling it, I was not enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, I was out of control completely. And I didn't know whether it was going to be one drink that got me drunk or after, you know, drinking the whole fifth of Jack Daniels, I'd be up and dancing on the bar, you know, or after one drink, I'd be calling you up and crying, you know, about my life, you know, because I just did not know what was going to happen to me. And I went to this school, and oh golly, I remember at that time my son was with his father up in Northern California. He was about 5 years old, and he was up there for Christmas, and my husband's business was having a slump, and he wasn't able to send me as much money, so I decided I needed to get a job, and so that was when it used to be called May Company, or one of them, I can't remember, Robinson May, I don't know. Anyway, I went to get a job, this retail job, and so when you go to get a job, you know, they have you fill out an application, and they ask you questions like, have you ever been arrested? And I thought, well, yeah.
There really was something there.
And I had been arrested for, possession, dangerous drugs, weapons, receiving stolen property, manufacturing, possession of this. I mean, a whole A to Z laundry list of, how could I write that down? If you write that down, they're not going to hire you, right? And if you don't write it down, they're going to find out and they're going to fire you. So I didn't know what to do. I just left and got drunk. I mean, I couldn't even fill out the application, you know? And I got to tell you, I know that there's young people there around here, and, maybe you're just starting to get your first job or whatever, There's always somebody who's gone through that same thing. You can always get a solution to the problems of these kinds of things. You can always find somebody that's been married more times or owes more money to the IRS than you, in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got sober, they told me I never had to do anything alone. And that's been true for me. But in any case, so that particular Christmas of 83, I didn't get that job. I was still in school, and so I was supposed to graduate somewhere around February, March, and I knew that this is fish or cut bait, I gotta do something about my life, And for a while, my son came down and lived with me, and I was just a mess. I mean, I'd be drunk every night, and I'd get up in the morning, and I'd see some horrible mess on the stove, and I'd say, what is this? And he'd say, oh, Mom, that was dinner. You made it. And I'm like, oh, my God, And any moms out there know that, when you go to pick up your child from daycare like an hour and a half late, they are not happy to see you, And there's just your little son and the teacher's sitting there on the curb, And I mean, it gives new meaning to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, And I had to get sober, and I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And I had one of the last drunks I had was so pitiful. I had this competition with a girl in school, and I wanted to best her on the final. And so I stayed home and I studied, and I stayed up for 3 days on beer and Dizoxin, and I memorized every single bit of information I needed to, and I took the final and I beat her by 2 points, And then I went out and bought 6 canned cocktails and went up to the lounge and got drunk and passed out, And it was just pitiful. And I had teachers my whole life tell me, you have so much potential. I never knew what they were talking about. I started calling Alcoholics Anonymous because I had heard about it, and I knew by this time that I was an alcoholic. And so what happened for me was I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called AA, LA Central Office. And I just want to interject something here about commitments. James talked about commitments. Commitments are the absolute best thing. When I got sober, I went to 6 meetings a week. I had a commitment at every single meeting. And I had a child, too, And the central office that I called in LA, I later had a commitment there for 8 years, every other Thursday answering phones. It was one of the best commitments I ever had, because it really got me in touch with people that were new and were trying to get sober. And I so anyway, what happened was I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was early on a Saturday, and I had already been drinking.
And it was maybe early afternoon, and this woman at central office said, well, do you think you could, like, not drink for the rest of the day, and we'll send somebody over to pick you up? And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I can do that, you know, and I hung up the phone. Not. I mean, you know, I was on my way out the door to get another bottle, and they called me back. And they called me back, and they said, wait there, we're coming to get you. Now, the first miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I did that, that I waited. You know, see, because I never did anything anyone told me to do. You know, I was like, don't tell me nothing. I'll figure it out for myself. You know, and that's the way I felt. But I waited there, and what happened was these two women came over in this giant alcoholic mobile. I mean, it was like a 1971 Ford Fairlane, pre-first oil crisis. It was about as big as my living room, you know. And there were these two gals in there, and, you know, they piled me in the back. And what happened was we were going to go to this meeting on a Saturday night. And they had picked me up relatively early for this meeting for, I got sober in the Pacific Group. It was early even for Pacific Group standards. But the reason they picked me up so early was because they were going to stop at the hospital to visit another sober member of our fellowship who was ill with something else. And so they stopped to get her flowers. Because that's what we learn to do. You know, that's what we learn how to do for each other. That's the fellowship, showing up for each other when there's baby showers or when there's weddings or when there's somebody dies, you know, and we show up for the memorial or the... We learn how to do that here, you know. And guess what? You know, all of our friends will come, you know. So they stopped to get some flowers, and the woman came back to the car, and she had two bunches of flowers, and she gave one to me. And there was a little card in there that said, stay with us in the fellowship of AA, and you don't ever have to be alone again. You know, and I had no idea how she knew how lonely I felt. You know, alcoholics are the only people that try to cure loneliness by isolating. You know, it doesn't work. You know, it just, we like to stay in our room and drink. It doesn't work. You know, oh, I'm not feeling too good. I don't think I should go to the meeting. Go to the meeting, click, you know, and you show up. Take that commitment, show up. That's what commitments will do. They will get you to a meeting when nothing else will. If you got the cookie commitment and everyone's counting on you to bring in the cookies, you better get them cookies to that meeting, and you better get your butt in the chair too, because that's what'll, you know, you gotta go to meetings until you want to go to meetings, you know, and then you get to go to meetings. And so anyway, we get to this meeting. And I got to tell you, I did not look the way I look tonight. I was wearing black, dirty jeans that were so filthy they could probably stand up in the corner by themselves. A leather jacket with torn lining coming out of it. My hair was kind of green and my face was yellow. You know, I don't know how they knew I was new. You know, you know. But, and I went to this meeting, and it was Saturday night at the Federal Building in West LA. There was a million people there, you guys. I mean, they were all smiling and shaking hands and handing me their phone numbers and, what, you know, what are you, new? And I was like, a million people. And the meeting went on and on and on. And then they had the birthdays, and then they ended the meeting, and then they had a party for someone that was 10 years sober, you know. And this woman was opening these gifts, and she got all these little tchotchkes, you know. And I was like, oh, my God, I can just see it now. Your whole house is filled with that crap, you know. I was like, get me out of here. You know, I got to tell you, I love that woman. She's still sober today, and I just saw her not too long ago, Lynn. She lives out in the Redlands area, you know. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you know. And it took me about 3 weeks before my car didn't, like, automatically turn into the liquor store, you know, and you know, because I heard this, I listened to the speakers. I listened to what I can't remember his name right now, but he used to talk about, how do you not drink? Well, you just don't lift your elbow to your mouth with the liquor. And I, sounds like a good idea, you know, I could probably do that, you know. And when I was new, I used to write things down. I used to, you know, there was a saying that, you know, just because things aren't going my way doesn't mean they're going wrong. Wow, what a concept. You know, they talk to me about God's will. How do I know if it's my will or God's will? Well, chances are, if you got to really stuff it, fold it, spindle it, mutilate, and screw it to get it to happen, it's not God's will, you know? But if it does happen with prayer and meditation and taking the action, I learned that what I had to do here was to take the action, and the results were out of my hands, you know? And, you know, so I got sober in that first year. I mean, I got a sponsor. I mean, it was not easy for somebody like me. You know, I was 30-something years old, and I had lived on my own since I was 16. And it was like, well, I haven't done too bad. I did not embrace the second half of the first step. I did not believe my life was unmanageable, even though it clearly was, you know, unmanageable. But I, you know, for me to surrender my will, you know, I couldn't quite get that surrender to win. You know, I just thought about surrender, Dorothy, you know, and I was, but I went to the meetings and I got commitments. My girlfriend Julie, who came over to my 25th party, and, we both had children about the same age, and, you know, I remember us, we picked up cigarette butts and clean toilets for years up in Ohio, at Ohio Street, you know, and that was when we still washed cups, you know, we still had China cups. And, just, you know, I mean, we went to meetings and we went to parties and we went to watches. And we worked the steps. You know, I was told that the fellowship of AA is a great thing, and that's what all the parties and all the things are. But the meetings where they keep the newcomers is where I need to be every night. If I drank every day, I needed to be in a meeting every night. And if I, and I needed to work the steps, you know. And I did that, you know. I turned my will and my life over to care of God. And you know, things happen. Things happen in sobriety. They really do. I was about 4.5 years sober, and my son got hit by a car. And, I mean, it was, you know, it was bad. I mean, I didn't know. And it was, fortunately, it was a Saturday, and I for some reason, I wasn't working, because I used to work on Saturday. But I get this call from his buddy saying, your Brendan's been hit by a car, you know. And I had just gotten out of the shower, so I threw on my pants and threw on a shirt and went running down the street. And here's my kid laying out in the middle of the street, you know, with his leg over to the side and all bloody on the head, and his bike is all tore up. But the thing was, is that I had medical insurance. Actually, I had a boyfriend that I wasn't even seeing at that time. He was in the program and was still helping me pay for the medical insurance because he insisted that I needed it. And so the ambulance came, and I was like, take us to Cedars. I have insurance. Take us to Cedars. And my son was in the hospital in traction for a month, you know, and then he was at home in a body cast for another 6 months, you know. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous showed up for us, you know. They came over and they read to him. They brought him things. When I turned 5 years sober, they loaded him into the back of a flatbed truck and brought him to the party, you know, in this huge plaster cast that went from here all the way down one leg and halfway down the other leg, you know. And, you know, it was amazing. It was just amazing that people showed up for us. I want to talk about money, finances. You know, I don't know about you, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know what it was to be self-supporting through my own contributions. You know, I just didn't. I mean, I came from an era of a budget was your old man brings home a sack full of $100 bills, you spend it till it's gone. You know, and then you worry about it. You know. I didn't even know what it cost to live. My first job in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got after I graduated from that course of school. And I didn't even know what to ask for. I was like, he said, what do you want for salary? I'm like, oh, well, I don't know, whatever you think. I mean, I totally did not know. So I had all these debts, and I had credit cards, and I didn't know what it was to live on a budget, you know. And so I went to finance class, and he was supposed to help me learn how to do this, you know. And now I'm a person that can barely add two numbers and have them come out the same twice in a row, you know. So, but here's what a devious alcoholic I am. The first year I was in finance class, I kept two sets of books, you know, because he wouldn't let me buy stuff. You know, he would say, I'd say, I need a new suit for work. He'd say, well, how much does it cost? I'd say, well, it costs $200. He goes, you can't buy it. That's too much. What do you mean that's too much? That's what it costs. I need it. He'd say, you can't buy it. I'd say, okay. And I'd buy it anyway. I write my checkbook Safeway, Thrifty, 50, you know, I write five checks for $50. It was a mess. It was a total mess, you know. I just lied for a whole year. And so finally, after a year, I thought, you know, I better get honest because I'm going to have to learn how to do this, you know. I had to surrender my Porsche. I hated that man telling me to do that, you know. God, you know, and I got this little poopy Dodge Colt. I hated that car, you know. And but anyway, what happened with that was I learned to live self-supporting under my own contributions. And that finance sponsor used to tell me, you know, I want you to learn how to save money. I want you to, every week when you get paid, I want you to put $5 in a savings account. I thought, I can't do that. They're going to laugh at me. They're going to laugh at me, you know? Well, I got to tell you, they never laughed at me at the bank. And the money that I saved from that little bit, that little job for the first several years, I took my son on his first trip abroad, and we went to Spain in 1992, you know, and that has given rise to a huge love of travel in him, you know, and he's traveled all over the world. And you know, we learn how to do things here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we learn that we can ask somebody. I don't have to know the answer to everything. I can say, you know what, let me get back to you. I need to talk to my sponsor about that, you know, because I don't know what's right for me, you know, but I got a sponsor whose voice is louder than my head, who is not emotionally involved in my life, you know, so she can help me look at things, and she can help me work the steps, and she can help me get out of myself, because you know what, it's not all about me, and if I'm thinking about you and what you need, I'm not thinking about me, and that's a good thing, you know. My time is almost up, but you know, I want to just talk a few minutes about the 11th step, because the 11th step is my favorite step, you know. I mean, I truly believe this is a spiritual program, you know, and I cannot stay sober. You see, because I don't do clean and sober. I do drunk and falling off a toilet with a needle in my arm is what I do. And I should be dead. I overdosed a number of times. I should be one of those statistics of, you know, of people that did not make it, you know. But I feel very, very blessed to have this program. And every day when I get up and I do that 11th step and I get on my knees and I ask God to help me stay sober and I ask, you know, that for His will, because I don't know, you know, I'm going, you know, everybody's going through tough times right now and the economy, you know, is wacko and, you know, where's it going to go? And I'm 25 years older than when I first got here, you know, and the money's not right. But you know what? I do believe, you know, that God has a plan, you know, and He didn't get me this far just to drop me, you know. And I do believe that if I do these things, if I show up and if I go to meetings and I take commitments, if I work with others, I work the steps and I pray on my knees, the chances are I'm not going to have to go out and live the way I used to live. The chances are I'm going to be able to conduct myself with, as a woman, with some dignity and some grace and some love in my heart, and let that shine through to you. Chances are I don't have to go out and live like I did, which was an animal, just like an animal, and I would be dead. And it was all through the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps, and, you know, just showing up and doing the deal one day at a time, you know, that I get to stay here, and I think that's a pretty good deal. So thanks for letting me share.